he used this to set limits on other things too with the appropriate theory. You probably all know this, but the Oklo phenomenon is, when I say this, I'm referring to the site of several naturally occurring uranium fission reactors. In total, there were something like 20 different reactor zones that were found, and the effects of these were found in 1972. So they were found by this staff member of the Barilot fuel processing plant. And what he noticed was that the isotopic abundance of U-235 was depleted in some of his samples. And it was thought that the isotopic abundance of U-235 was more or less a fundamental constant at that time. Its source was well known, and nobody had ever, it was found to be roughly the same all over the entire Earth. And so when they found this, they were quite surprised. And in fact, with rare exceptions, these isotopic abundance ratios are very constant. Lead and osmium, you're probably familiar with, they come from different sources. And so as these sources are spread out different places in the solar system or on Earth, there's a slightly different isotopic abundance for these.
Uncertainty associated with those numbers. They seem awfully close to make a statement about whether or not there's unusually, anomalously low U-235.
They were used to getting about 5 digits of precision in the U-235, 4 or 5 digits of precision.
But they choose it for all deposits, because I think there were people who before that suggested the photonuclear reactors like Kuroda. Mm-hmm. His statement was that it's quite a probable situation, but before that, people did not look accurate.
They didn't take him seriously.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that
that's the next slide.
Perhaps they did not look carefully, and perhaps this universal constant was a constant, let's say, for 5 years. I mean, with such accuracy.
Well, they had been mining this mine for 40 years. I apologize.
Even a few deposits were already completely taken off when it was discovered. So.
Yeah. So from a particular mine, they were used to 4 or 5 digits of accuracy on this, and then averaged over all of the samples. And initially they didn't. From the history that I read about this, they kept track of where the samples were coming from, but they were doing blind testing of the isotopic abundances, and just part of the regular process for processing this fuel. And so they had a couple of explanations why this might be. They thought they might have some contamination in their uranium fluoride gas. They ruled that out, and then they started comparing to these crazy ideas, crashing nuclear spacecraft, evidence of prehistoric civilization, or the Germans were stealing it. They tracked this back. They discovered where the samples had come from, and all came from this one area. All the samples that showed low abundance came from Gabon, Africa. And in fact, they found that in some of the samples, upon closer inspection, were missing half of the U-235. So quite an amazing depletion. And then doing a bit of a literature search, they discovered that Paul Kuroda had already hypothesized the existence of a natural uranium reactor, and he wrote a couple of papers on the process, and in fact it appears that he was almost in all the details that he put in, he was correct. And a nice review of this was given by George Count in Scientific American, and I've stolen a bit from him. I'll show you later in his talk. So what do we need to have a nuclear reactor? This is all fairly well known now, but we need a fairly high abundance of U-235. With very few exceptions, with one exception I know of, you cannot in fact get you cannot operate a fission reaction with today's abundance of U-235. And the one situation in which you can is if you use deuterium as a moderator or heavy water. So you also need a very low concentration of neutron absorbers, and you need something to moderate it. In this case, the most readily available thing for moderation is water, and you need a big enough deposit so that you can have a reasonable probability of recapturing the neutrons that are emitted. So you see that on the order of the time of Oplo, there was probably about 3.7% of U235 abundant in Oplo, 1.8 billion years ago. In fact, this just shows you kind of what you should expect. So interestingly enough, when the Earth was formed, it's about 25% U235, and makes one think that it's possible that there were other reactors operating at that time as well, that are in fact much, much older. So you know, these are all fairly well known, extremely well known, and we can use these use this fact to estimate what was necessary at the time of Oplo. So this is the one condition that I was talking about before. Can have heavy water and fairly high abundance of heavy water compared to the amount of uranium. And in fact, you can get this is showing the one of the most important parameters here is this multiplication factor. That tells you how many neutrons you get absorbed into uranium for every one neutron emitted. And so when uranium fissions, when U235 fissions, you get between 2 and 3 free neutrons with a few MeV of energy. And in fact, about 2.47 on average. So if you put that in and run a calculation for a homogeneous reactor, homogeneous meaning the moderator and the uranium are equally mixed throughout the sample and continue to be equally mixed throughout the fission reaction. So you can get a fission reaction, a sustained fission reaction with deuterium oxide, but not with water. And in fact, these are the optimum values for each. And you can see that the multiplication factor is less than 1 in all cases, except for D2O. So this allows us also to set some. A question then is, what do we need in order to be able to test possible time variation of fundamental constants with Oplo? So we obviously have to have something that varies as a function of energy. Something that varies, and this doesn't have to vary as a function of energy. In this case, that's what I'm focusing on. I'm focusing on a few things that vary as a function of energy. But the neutron spectrum in a reactor is fairly flat at high energies. So we really need something with a low energy absorption where the neutron spectrum has some shape, so that it has some sensitivity, the amount of the rate of the reaction, and is dependent on its position in that region of the spectrum where the spectrum has some shape. But we also need a bunch of other things. We have to have isolated, well-preserved samples. We have to know what its natural abundance is. In fact, we have to know what its abundance was at the time of the reactor, and also the history. That's where isolated plays a role. So these are things that we're looking for in the Oplo reaction, or in the Oplo reactors. And then, of course, we have to know what happens during the reaction. We have to know the effect of the neutron captures in particular. And then we have to have some model for the energy dependence of this neutron resonance. And this is one of the bigger issues right here. We have to have a model for the dynamics of the O4 reactor. And then finally, to really put some solid numbers on time variation of various fundamental parameters, we of course, have to have a model that relates this shifting in what we're looking at, shifting energy, with a change in the fundamental parameters. So this is a history, kind of a summary slide actually, of various tests that were made, various analyses that were made of the OFLO data to determine possible time variation of the fine structure constant. In all cases, even though we know the field has become somewhat more sophisticated now, and all of the dependence of this resonance energy isn't put on this term, what I've called C of alpha here, we also know that it's quite possible that that there's a significant contribution from this term C of lambda and potentially others. I put all of these in the same, calculated these all in the same, with the same method, just to give a comparison. You could also take these numbers to be directly proportional to the change in the resonance energy. So you see that we,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know about it.
Is there any reason why I didn't place it here?
Not in particular, no.
Okay.
I know of this paper, and in fact, we discussed it. Petrov and I discussed it at some point. But this isn't meant to be a complete history, I guess. It's just some ideas of what's been done. In particular, it was motivation for the work that Steve and I did, which was inspired by the number that came out from Fuji, which we knew was incorrect, but we didn't know how it was incorrect. And I'll tell you why later. I mean, we didn't know which way the number would shift. But we understood that they had used some incorrect analysis, and so we were inspired to try to fix that. So I'm going to diverge for just a few minutes and tell you a little bit about OPLO, kind of give you a feel for what it means to try to set these limits and collect the data, and how nature conspires to make this difficult for us. But so you all know OFLO is in West Africa, and this is Gabon, and OFLO, the OFLO mine site is over here, which on this map is something like over here, and it's important to note most of Gabon is very old, about 600 million years old or older, Precambrian rock. This is important because it gives some kind of stability for these samples. You know, there's bedrock near these deposits that is much older than the deposits themselves. And so it gives us some idea that this can be a stable place for the samples. They could sit there for a while. This is a picture of the mine and somebody standing near this one of the reactor zones. These reactor zones were on the order of a meter in diameter and maybe 3 meters long. Kind of on average, they took all shapes, but and some of them were dug up before we knew that they were there and were disturbed. Some others were discovered only by borehole drilling, and we have better samples from those. So this is what happened in OFLO, that there was a large amount of uranium that was spread out on the surface of the Earth, that is probably the sort of the quadrivalent uranium oxide that isn't very soluble in water, but it is soluble enough that it found its way into the bottoms of these stream beds and just kind of sat there for millions and millions of years. And at some point, the Earth was then covered with blue-green algae, which produced a huge amount of oxygen. And this oxygen then allowed the uranium, this quadrivalent uranium, to become hexavalent uranium, which is highly soluble in water. And at that point, all of these deposits were ready to flow all down into this delta where they stayed. And they actually ended up, they then had to become somehow insoluble. So it's thought that that it basically got buried in the mud and the decay products of the blue-green algae and all the other plant life that was there at the time. And we're in then a reducing environment, which they became less oxidized, and then were insoluble. So they're heavy, and they're now insoluble, and so they formed a layer of ore. And this layer of ore then was buried by sediment over millions of years. And as it was compacted and settled more and more, it started to react, and we started having these natural reactors, which are kind of, you know, shown here as artist's conception of these little red, dark red spaces. And they were all, this thought, well isolated from the environment. But in order for them to form actual reactor zones, there needed to be a moderator. So this uplift of this very old rock that was near it broke the sedimentary rock apart, and some water infiltrated this deposit and formed these reactor zones. So the water acted as the moderator, allowed the fission reaction to be sustained for long periods of time, and you know, then we found it. Some of the sedimentary rock was eroded, and we were able to find these deposits and use them for our purposes. So they started by, you know, digging this away, and they found these various reactor zones, and then they started digging, you know, as a matter of normal testing for the ore, trying to find the ore. They drilled these deep mine shaft or deep bore samples, and found some reactor zones this way too. So the best data have actually come from the samples, the reactor zones that were still buried in the earth. So here's a diagram of some of the zones. Like I said, there were 20 some zones that were found ultimately. Some of the data that I'm going to show you today came from zone 2. After they found it, they stopped mining it, and took a bunch of samples that made their way out to various institutions, including Los Alamos. And another one is zone 10, which isn't shown here, but it has some different characteristics, similar data, different size. It's estimated that the reactors operated for on the order of 100,000 years. And we know this because we know that some of the samples actually showed an increase in the amount of U-235 above the natural isotopic abundance. This can only come from alpha decay of the plutonium-239, or the subsequent decays of plutonium-239. And so this has a lifetime of about 30,000 years. And so we know that we're actually breeding plutonium 239. The reactors were breeding plutonium 239, and so this kind of sets a limit on the age. But there are some other data too, and this more recent work by Meshik is very interesting. It shows that the reactors operated in a sort of discontinuous fashion. It's thought what happened is the water seeped in and it heated up, and it blew the water out, and it stopped the reaction. And until it could cool back down and water could seep back in, it was cold, or it was not functioning. Until it was cold, it wasn't functioning. So in fact, it probably looked a lot like this. I'm not suggesting that Old Faithful is driven by a natural reactor, but in all reality, it probably did look something like this. These reactor zones going off for 100,000 years. So now I'm kind of working down my list here of things that we have to have in order to be able to test for time variation of fundamental parameters. And one of the things that we need is we need to know the reactor produced abundances. And so what I'm showing you is that all of these are well tabularized data. We know the fission products of U-235 fission. We know the subsequent decay channels very, very well. This was all mapped out for reasons you all know, including scientific reasons. And in particular, here's samarium 149. And it shows we have a very, it has a very long lifetime. My apologies, this is a scan of a very old book. But it has a lifetime here of something like 10 to the 15 years. And it decays, or 10 to the 15 seconds, I'm sorry, and primarily decays via gamma decay, although it's kind of hard to tell that's gamma. What's also very, very good for our purposes is that the other isotopes of samarium are also very long-lived. And this helps us very, very much because we can, one of the main handles we have on this, the position of this neutron resonance is the isotopic, relative isotopic abundances of the others. I'll show you that in a second. We also have to have well-preserved samples. And so we know from measurements that the lanthanides are all fairly stable in that deposit. And we've been able to look at things like neodymium and obviously samarium and gadolinium and have been able to determine that those are all, they all match our expectations for what we should get out of a reactor. And so this is an area for some discussion and concern in setting limits on these, but it's believed that these are these were all fairly well retained in the sample. So just as an example, let's look at neodymium. So we have natural neodymium has isotopic abundances that look something like this, and from fission we get something like this. You notice a total absence of neodymium 142, and we see that neodymium from the Oklo ore has a little bit of 142 in it. In a way, this isn't an ideal situation because we would like to see no neodymium 142. This suggests that there's a bit of contamination by some natural source. But if we take off that natural source, we can subtract off what we think this represents in terms of a natural abundance. We can correct and it may make the Oklo data look exactly like what we expect directly from U-235 fission. Well, we can do that also with samarium. And I didn't do the correction here, but these are actual data. This is the blue boxes here are the natural abundances of four different samarium isotopes, 144, 47, 48, 149. We're most interested, of course, in 149. So you see there's a fairly large natural abundance of samarium 149. And we're left in the end with no samarium 144, a very small amount of 149, and the relative abundance of 147 is very high. This allows us to, these are actually fairly strongly constraining parameters in the numerical analysis that we did based on these data. And so I'd like to then show you basically how we, that more of the data that we used. One more bit that we need here is the position of this resonance. So you see this resonance is well mapped out today. And we know that the energy here is 97.3 millielectron volts. Data come from several places. What's that? What is the signature? Oh, well, you can see. I mean, they have a model. This is probably the Breit-Wigner approximation, or you know, or actually it's not, but it, with several resonances, it could be.
Square root of energy.
Yeah, square root of energy. No. So we can do some statistics on the data points that are right there and see that this isn't going to change by much. You know, it's the uncertainty is probably on the order of a fraction of a millielectron volt.
A fraction.
It's 97.3 millielectron volts. Yeah, it's fraction of a millielectron, a few percent.
Okay.
Yeah. So we have two more bits here, and we have this low energy neutron resonance. And from the theory, excuse me, and from various measurements, we also know the effect of neutron captures on this resonance. And so here's a bit more about the effect of the known effects of the neutron captures on the resonance. We know all of these factors. So what these factors are parameters that go into this what we call the Breitwigner approximation of the neutron resonance. And so we have things like the neutron width and the gamma width here, and we know their energy dependence. And these things have all been derived from measured data, and so we can use these in our mathematical model with expected good accuracy. So what we do then is we calculate the cross section from this theory, and in fact we use this effective cross section. So we have to have a neutron flux. And the neutron energy, these are just related by a velocity. And what we do then is we pull out the velocity at which all of the 1 over V absorbers cross sections were measured, and which is on the order of 2200 meters per second. And so for U235, we know its cross section. It's just a constant. It's in this theory. And so now we have the energy dependence of this neutron resonance is defined through the Breitwigner approximation. So we're almost there. Now we need a model for the reactor dynamics. The last thing we need in order to be able to set some limit on the stability of that energy, stability of that resonance energy. We need one more thing too. We have to have another way of calculating the cross section. So we actually take the data here. All of these data above this line are parameters that go into the numerical solution of these differential equations, and these cross sections are then the output of the solution to these differential equations. Then we need a model for the reactor dynamics. And so what Fuji et al. Did, and DeMore and Dyson and Scheilecker, who came up with the original idea, they all used the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution for the neutron spectrum. And this is clearly wrong. You can't use the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution for anything but a system that's in thermal equilibrium. This is not in thermal equilibrium. There are absorbers present. And in fact, the reactor wouldn't be operating if there weren't absorbers present. And U235 is a strong absorber of the neutrons, and so the neutrons are clearly not in thermal equilibrium. But this is a valid approximation for some level of determining the stability of these things, stability of this energy. But Fuji et al. Pushed it a little too far. And so they got much better data, and then used the same analysis. And the better data actually required a better analysis, and so that's what I want to show you on this slide. So they came up with two solutions. Differential equation determines experimentally determined cross sections fit into this band here, this red band. And then using the Breitwigner approximation and an estimated neutron spectrum, which in their case they use a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, you get a series of curves here that depend on temperature. So it makes sense. So you get the temperature plays a fairly significant role in determining what the cross section would be. And so there's one area here. Centered near, or not quite centered, but near zero, zero change in the energy. And another one here, this is the so-called two-solution problem. And we don't have accurate enough data on another element in order to really definitively determine one solution over the other. I should have plugged this in. We do that. But this, for probably sociological reasons, is sort of preferred by many.
It's not even two solutions. In principle, there are many resonances. So
yeah.
I'm thinking it's millions of solutions.
Okay.
But yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Assuming that variation is small as possible. Okay?
Yeah. So we assume the variation is small, and we come up with a preference for this solution. Now there are potentially data on gadolinium-155, but the samples from Oklo are contaminated, and they're contaminated with natural abundance of gadolinium. Gadolinium is more mobile. For some reason, and there was also natural abundance of gadolinium in that area.
It's a different distribution because of absorbers.
A different distribution because of absorbers? Yeah. Well, this is a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution so far.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to tell you how we changed this analysis. We did all of the same analysis up to this point, and then we tried to model the reactor better. And we did model the reactor better. And this is actually a very fun project for me. I got to learn many of the details of how reactors operate. And
just a quick question.
Yes.
Previous picture, if there is no absorbers, is it correct result or not?
If there's no which?
If there are no absorbers.
Yeah, but then there's no reactors.
No, just a second. Is it correct result in absence of no absorbers? No mistake.
With some caveats, yeah.
Now, formulate the question differently. Have you reproduced this result?
Yes.
Yes. So
yes.
This is your picture in absence of absorbers.
This is a picture that I snagged out of this paper, but we calculated the exact same distribution using our code and no absorbers.
Okay, this is an issue.
Yes, absolutely, perfectly. Yeah,
okay.
So there's no difference.
Do you tell about normalization of the flux?
The which?
Normalization of the flux.
Harmonization of the flux?
Yeah. How many neutrons was so in here you discussed Z distribution,
mm-hmm.
and the question is how many we get.
We have that number. I didn't put it on these.
You explained how you get it.
Sure. Yeah, I more or less did, but okay. I mean, we normalize.
Yeah.
Right, and so we're concerned mostly with the normalized value to calculate the cross section. So we can in principle calculate an absolute value as well, and we know that the flux, the total flux, is about 10^21 neutrons per centimeter over 100,000 years. You know, over that whole 100,000 years, the integrated neutron flux was
It's probably from decay of uranium-235. You know, depletion. You assume that there is certain amount of uranium-235. When you see that the number of uranium-235 is small, you can calculate how many neutrons were emitted. Probably.
The answer of numbers because of contamination, I don't know how.
No. It is what I know, but maybe Justin knows more.
Yeah, so.
I think it was always reference to some potential scale. About some other isotope of neodymium, perhaps. So that's what I wonder. So. What did you really use to estimate?
We didn't use data on neodymium to estimate that. What we did is basically solve these differential equations for the known abundances, and so this in principle gives us the number of the total flux. I mean, it does give us the number. It's something that's calculated along the way.
If it was some.
We didn't.
Some chemical phenomena we should use density of some elements for some remnants.
No, I understand, but our analysis is self-consistent. We didn't collect those data from another source.
Okay, it's self-consistent in the sense that you can reproduce it.
Yes.
But the question is whether the
So you're asking if we can add additional data and make it better.
So
potentially.
Not make it better. The question is whether you estimate systematic effects.
Because he hasn't told what they've done yet. Okay.
Not yet. Perfect. Okay. So as I was saying, we buried a lot of physics in this multiplication factor here, and it's not worth going through all of the details. But some of the parameters here are, you know, we have multiplication factors and. You know, average neutrons per fission, resonance escape probability is reasonably intense calculational result here. And so this is, you can think of this as being the probability that that a fast neutron actually gets past the nucleus and isn't absorbed. But we put all of these parameters into the multiplication factor, and then we calculated. I guess you can see multiplication factor here for various levels of absorbers. And you can see that for no absorbers, you get and 3.7% U235, you get a multiplication factor that goes above one for only a few hydrogens. And as you increase the number of absorbers, you have to have more and more hydrogen present. This ratio of hydrogen to uranium, this number has to increase in order for you to have a multiplication factor that supports this natural fission reaction. And after you get to about 11 or 12 barns of absorbing power, so to speak, we can no longer support natural reactor even at this even the 3.7% natural U235. So what this says is that there is fairly tight constraint on the amount of on the number of absorbers that can be present in the reactor. This somewhere between 0 and 10 is a very reasonable level to assume, and we can't go beyond. Beyond 10, the reactor wouldn't be supported anyway. So this is what we did. Then we calculated neutron spectra using a Monte Carlo simulation. That's it's a well-accepted method of calculating the neutron spectrum. We put in our multiplication factor and the absorbers, and we calculated then what kind of spectrum you get for various levels of absorbers. So for absorbing to scattering ratio of one, we get something like this. And so what happens here is that these are all normalized spectra. So what's happening is that the low energy neutrons are just being eaten away. They're not present in here anymore. And for lower and lower absorption, you see that there are more and more of the low energy neutrons present, and the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution does the overestimates the number of slow neutrons present, and it's the slow neutrons that we really care about, because this is where this resonance is. It's sitting in here. It should be shifted over here, but it's sitting right about here, where this has quite a bit of curvature. So when we do that, we come up with solutions, a family of solutions that look like this. So our data come to the same conclusion because we're using the same experimental data and solving essentially the same differential equations for these experimental values of the cross section. But in a sense, we're only allowing one solution here. I mean, there's a whole family of solutions you can see that extend all the way out here. But if we limit the temperature to a couple hundred degrees, we're really only limiting this. Now, at the time when we did this analysis, and these are the same data that we published in this paper here, I didn't change them for the purpose of this talk. But since we published this, there's data have come out that show that the reactor actually operated probably at a very low temperature, maybe 200 or 300 degrees C. And so I didn't correct for that. In fact, the lowest temperature that we calculated was 300, which is the dotted blue line here. So you can see that this number would disagree. I don't have them here on the same plot, but this number for 300 degrees C, the number for 200 is actually shifted this way a little bit. That actually disagrees then with the data by both of the numbers disagree with the numbers that have been produced in the past by Fuji. But we know that this isn't the final answer, because we assume that our reactor is a homogeneous reactor of infinite extent. It's probably the single largest issue with this analysis. And we said that. And so even though we show that we've got a negative shift in this energy and therefore a positive shift in alpha, if you use the simplest of these analyses, and this is defined the same way as the astrophysical data. It's then minus now. And so we know that there's a problem with this. So the strongest statement that we were willing to make and are still willing to make about these data is that these data show that you probably can't use Oklo to disprove the idea that the alpha astrophysical alpha measurements are incorrect. So what can you say? Well, you have to do a better model. And so Steve went on and worked with a couple of theorists who were very good with MCMP calculations, the Monte Carlo neutron package that was developed. The Russians have their own, and then the US has their own. And it takes care of many more parameters, allows you to set finite sizes and things like this. And in the process, they decided to do a better job of solving these differential equations. So they added in a couple of things. They added in plutonium-239 breeding as a part of this, because we know the reactor operated for 100,000 years, which is sort of three times the plutonium-239 lifetime. And instead of putting in sort of an explicit decay here and an absorption parameter for the U-235, so I didn't define any of these before, but 5 refers to U-235, 9 to plutonium-239, and 8 to uranium-238. Everything else refers to samarium, an isotope of samarium. So these are fission product branching ratios, and obviously cross sections in the neutron flux. And then we have this parameter gamma, which includes this resonance escape probability that I showed you before. So solving this set of differential equations, and again, this is where you get the neutron flux from solving this using the data that are available.
What are the data? So the abundances or?
Samarium abundances.
When is samarium abundances?
Yeah, that's what, samarium abundance is the beginning and ending uranium abundances. These are all in principle known.
Yeah, okay. The relative signal of samarium against uranium.
Yes. Yeah. And plutonium in this case as well. Okay. So they added in plutonium as a correction factor. Then performing the, separately performing the Monte Carlo simulation, this more powerful, more sophisticated Monte Carlo program for generating the neutron spectra. It actually eats away even more of the slow neutrons down here, and in fact has more pronounced structure around this 100 million electron volt area that we care about so much. And then this is the result of that calculation. So a very similar result, a better neutron spectrum, some minor changes to the we think minor changes to the differential equations, and they get now numbers that are consistent with no change. At least this one is consistent with no change. Again, different from our result, which we knew to be incorrect because it was, we knew to be incomplete because it was a homogeneous reactor of infinite extent. So we still have this two solution problem, and you can argue we have the two solution problem in our homogeneous reactor of infinite extent as well. There are some things that could be taken into account in a better model, a better analysis, and probably the biggest is the finite temperature of the absorbers. The second biggest could be, or could be even bigger, is this idea that the reactor was inhomogeneous beyond its finite size. So it has size of 1 by 3 meters, but we also know from data that were collected that the actual fission, the zones that are most highly depleted in U-235 are only a couple of tens of centimeters in size, and they're centered around cracks in the ore samples. So these cracks filled with water and allowed the fission to occur only where there was a crack. So there are these very very highly depleted areas within these larger reactor zones. So again, we need a different model for the reactor, but at this point, I don't think there's enough excitement about doing it. It might take some time for somebody to get excited about doing that.
Just a question. Yeah. Maybe one other issue. Well, maybe I'll let you finish and then I'll ask.
Sure. I really only have one more slide that deals with this. So we know that it can be a sensitive test for time variation. This is true, but it is model dependent, and this causes some problems. A lot of them I've talked about, and maybe a few of them I've missed. I just talked about this additional inhomogeneity that we know to be present in the samples. But we estimated things like the chemical binding of the hydrogen to the water. You know, we treat them in our, everybody treats them as free protons, free scattering. That's not right, but it shouldn't change the result by more than a 10% say. I think that's an overestimate. We don't think that's a big deal. The data from other elements is not so good. So it may be that there's room for improvement there too. And then, of course, somebody needs to figure out what these parameters are if we want to set some limits on them.
You have another protocol, so yeah?
I think I'll stop here because I've taken up my time. But I can talk.
Okay, because I want to have some discussion with this now.
Yes.
If you wish, you can continue.
Yeah, sure.
So, does anybody have any questions?
Yes.
When you said that the unincluded effects are no more than 10%, it's 10% of what? So you have plus 0.4, then I'm going to say the 0.04, or is it 10% on the curves? Which
we don't think it'll change. We don't think it'll change our values of sigma by more than 10%.
Right.
You know, so some could shift up and some could shift down. So we, you know, it could. The curves are sloped.
Right. So is that translated to some systematic uncertainty that you could put on the numbers that you gave previously?
Yeah, we could. I could do that.
You'll still have two solutions, though, right?
Yeah, we still have two solutions.
Definitely.
There was another question, please.
About this bursting, where it, you know, is not a constant sustained reaction. Does that have any effect on the analysis, or is it really the integral of all of those bursts?
That wasn't taken into account.
But does it matter, or is it?
Principle,
yes.
Those are short-lived isotopes, which decay.
Yeah.
They exist for some time and then disappear. So it's not like continuously working reactor.
Right.
In fact, how do you date the start of the reaction?
By looking at the amount of some isotopes that whose lifetime we know and only comes from uranium. And so there's neodymium, the uranium itself can be used directly. And so these numbers are fairly well known. You know, it's 1.8 billion years ago. It could be 1.83, but a couple of different numbers out there. That's only a few percent off.
Is there anything more definite you can say about this Petrov analysis?
It's also my question, I may join my voice.
Yeah.
I was just waiting.
Yeah.
Because the error bar in Petrov analysis is substantially larger.
Yeah.
I don't know why, just substantially, several times.
Well, we went back and forth with them on that too. And they made some claims that we didn't think were valid. And
does anybody compare?
I guess I'm biased towards this, you know, the Sharpoff analysis, or Gould and Sharpoff analysis. I think they did it right, you know, and we had a hand in it. We were able to, you know, to know what was going on. So, I think they did a good job. With caveats, you know, there are some limits.
Because I know personally Yuri Petrov. By the way, it was his last work. He was dying at the time.
Yeah.
That's kind of memorial work. And he spent life calculating nuclear reactors.
Yeah.
I just possibly was stupid at that time, but I ended up in another course. So yeah. I wasn't simply discarded.
No, honestly, I had planned on covering another topic here, and this seemed like there was a lot of interest in this here, so I polished up another talk, and I didn't put that.
Also, it was recommended by Dyson. I gave Dyson your work, and he suddenly sent me a written report that I could not provide it because it was kind of personal. He was not very happy with this 2004 work.
Yeah.
No, so just to be interested, compared to approaches, say, Petrov.
We just calculated the numbers and reported the results. You know, we put a fair amount of physics into it.
But was it clear why your error bar is so much smaller than Petrov error bar?
Well, you can look at it. It's you can argue about where the error bar should be for sure. So you know we said that they all cut off here. And you know, this is the error bar. Nobody's worried about this error bar here, right? This is on this side. They're all worried about this one here that's on this side. And so, you know, we could maybe make some argument that we should center it more at 50, and then have this be plus 10. But you know, it's we had a method. We stuck to the method. We reported the number.
So far, this look the smallest error bar out of all.
Right, but we clearly stated the limitations of our analysis.
No, but you probably know the second block. The error bar is still very small.
Yeah, it is. It is very small.
It's very small. So it seems it's very small.
Uh-huh. Could you show that slide again, the Lamoureux and all of the results?
This one, or?
At the beginning, where you had
I put it here at the end as well. So these are, of course, not. Just think of these as limits on E right now, and multiply all these numbers by, you know, 2 × 10⁻¹.
Yeah, but the difference in the last two numbers, doesn't it suggest that the error bars are really underestimated in the, because the difference is much larger than the error bars.
The error bars are taken from the data too, right? I mean, it doesn't include systematic effects. Mm. It's just statistical. It's from, you know, kind of statistical. It's not even statistical. It's you know, we've calculated many temperatures, and we said we don't know enough about the temperature, so we're going to use that as the thing that sets the error bars for. So yeah, they're wrong. They're both.
So is it fair to say that you know, the systematic from the difference, the systematic errors are at least 20 × 10⁻¹⁸? Is it fair to say that?
Could be. Yeah, I really have to do a better analysis of that in order to say. It's probably worth doing that actually.
Okay. If any other questions?
Yeah. What's the prospect for finding more of these reactors around the world? You know,
that's
different time scales, different.
I have a slide for you.
Planets, maybe.
Planets. So this is interesting. Okay, this is. I knew this. Somebody was going to ask this question. I mean, it's a good question. So what's in pink is the worldwide distribution of U-235 to U-238 abundance. And you know, we have quite a few digits down here, so it's the same to within three digits, more or less, right? And 7.20 kind of. And what was found is that all of the data from New Mexico on the Colorado Plateau are much, much smaller. So the idea is that there were probably natural reactors on the Colorado Plateau, and they were eroded and mixed with the natural uranium that was there, so that, and in fact, there would be some places that are very, very depleted, and maybe we'll find those. But so far, nobody's found one.
And what about another carbon place? I think in Oakland it was about 20 deposits, but it was also some other place close to Oakland, is perhaps 6 or 8 mm-hmm. deposits.
Yeah.
Still,
so it would, I kind of refer to all that as Oklahoma, but it's not. You're right.
Yeah, so yeah. Still a few kilometers difference mm-hmm. could mean different contamination,
yeah.
chemistry, geology.
Right.
I don't know how how far it is, you, Dale, or Andy. I just remember that it was two places.
Yeah, it's, I think it's on the order of 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you use only just Opal.
The data I have are only from Opal. Yeah. And you know, there are samples that exist. People have samples that can be looked at again, but you know, they have pretty good numbers from the samples. So I don't think that's the issue. I don't think the answer is the issue is the samples. It's probably some of the issues are, you know, a better model of the reactor and its finite size and the finite size within the finite size and you know, this pulsating action, but also could be contamination. There's a lot we don't know. It sat there for 2 billion years, interacting with the environment.
Please to show this your last slide again.
Yes.
I just want to make a comment because it's continuous misunderstanding. You see, these numbers are good only to compare different uranium data. But I would strongly discourage people use these numbers to compare with laboratory data
right.
or statistics. And the reason is this coefficient is much bigger. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely no reason to neglect this term. I can justify neglection of this term. So I simply say there is no limit on alpha. And this is okay because this coefficient is small. But I would strongly discourage to neglect this coefficient. Actually, it's limit on this parameter. So these numbers cannot be compared to laboratory numbers or statistics. It's for internal use only. People just like to interpret results, present results this way.
I can say more that you know, there is no reason to think, well, there are lots of reasons to think that couplings may change on atomic scale, but not changing on the nuclear scale. It's also a possibility. So you will never compare the two by definition.
Because these numbers look very strong, and it looks like this current and experiment in laboratory. But I would say there are no of these numbers. It's for internal use only, for comparison different data.
So I have one more comment I want to make. It's mostly
case.
Anecdotal. Go ahead.
But Vicky, in this case, you should disencourage people who measure new variation in statistics.
No, it can be different. No, you don't understand me.
Well, you say that we can drop alpha coefficient and keep the second coefficient. And in this case, variation of part mass in respect to lambda QCD is about the same as variation of mu.
No, it's not a hypothesis that electron mass and quark mass are the same and so on. It requires.
So still, you are ready to disencourage somebody. It's better to say that the interpretation here is still not so simple and straightforward as in spectroscopic data. And in this case, it's again. To use the second term is better than to use the first term, but still it's even better to use logarithm of energy over delta t, and not variation on any particular constant.
Okay.
One more comment.
Yeah.
I'm also involved in search for a neutron electric dipole moment in Bosalamos, and I can supply some data that look the same. I can plot them on the same kind of graph here. I'll show you in a second, and some kind of plot. And what we see is searches for neutron electric dipole moments have been increasing in sensitivity. In the case for this plot, this is actually just the limit that's been set. And so then also, because these are all null experiments, it's also sort of the level at which they've been able to determine that the non-existence of a neutron electric dipole moment. But what I want to point your attention to mostly is the right-hand column. Neutron electric dipole moment searches have been very, very impressive in their ability to eliminate various fundamental theories. Yes?
Supersymmetry would typically overproduce the neutron electric dipole.
It has a big range, actually. It goes
all the way up to by two orders of magnitude above the bound.
Right? But some of this has been eliminated, right? I mean, you can't supersymmetry has been constrained by these data.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, putting it below the existing point is not a correct representation of the theory. Right?
Yes, I agree. But it doesn't quite fit because everybody else just has one point, and they have the whole axis.
So it's a line instead of point.
Right? Yeah, it's a line. It's a line.
It's a broad line because there are many parameters.
Yeah. But my point is that we have models here. You know, there are models that we can test by searching for neutron electric dipole moments, and we can do something similar. I can plot the data. They look kind of similar. You know, for this isn't a what I plotted here are only the limits on searching for time variation of alpha. Okay, just limits, and not the actual center value. So what I'm showing here is that the precision is getting better and better. And you know, of course, this is Jim's new number down here. It's fantastically good, and it drives the point home even more that this curve is really turning over, which is amazing. But we don't have anything on the right axis to speak of. We don't have things that people can point to.
So alpha slows down, right? Because alpha dot becomes
smaller. Yeah. Just a point of interest. Take it for what you will.
That's the error button.
Is it, let's see, or you want to say anything else?
No. Okay, so.